If you take a look on top of your folders, we had asked a question last when the Permanent School Trust Lands folks were in about how much money we had received for the trust lands that went into the Voyageurs National Park. We did get paid for those. We have never been paid for anything in the Boundary Waters, but we did get paid for the essentially 25,000 acres that were put into the Voyageurs Park. There were, I believe, about 90,000 acres in the Boundary Waters that we have never been paid for. So it isn't like we're done working on that issue. So we have three bills before us. Representative Dempsey, are you available?
Yes, ma'am.
All right. Let's move ahead with yours. After we have a... Do we have a quorum? After we have a quorum, I'll officially move your bill. Representative Dempsey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, I'm State Representative Jerry Dempsey. I represent School District 28A. My background is education, both as a classroom teacher and school administration. And what I bring forward today is a piece of legislation that doesn't have to cost the school districts a nickel. And it will work. And it's providing a solution to a problem. And the solution is workable. And so it is for that reason that I want to present to you House File 512. Before I explain that, I might mention to you that there are several other things, and Madam Chair, I don't know if you want to hear those maybe at a later time or whatever, or even today I can make it rather briefly, that my comments. But we also had another program in our school called the GROW program. Didn't cost a nickel to fund from the state. Was very successful, and so on. We also had teacher evaluations in our school. I don't think many school districts do that, but we had that. And we also had an announcement program. All of those solved problems. So I'm coming to you today with a solution to the problem that is totally voluntary. If the school districts do not want to use it as a solution to their problems, don't use it. Not making it a mandate. And sometimes we have a tendency to mandate and mandate it'll solve the problems. It won't. It hasn't. We've seen, some of you don't probably remember that far because you're not as old as I am, but we had a program at one time called Profiles of Learning. We've had outcome-based education. And you know what? We're looking at a third one. We're looking at a third program that we're going to have for the public schools. I think three strikes and out isn't what we want. So I'm trying to help out by giving you some information in regard to a solution to the problem. And the problem was this. We have school districts, including the district where I was in, at one time, we had for kids that were disciplined problem students or whatever else the case may be, or used wrong language in the school or did something wrong to another student or whatever. And it was called, as you can well see in regard to this, it was out of school suspension. And our school district looked at that and said, we have a slogan in our school that was, everybody is somebody in our school. And if somebody is somebody, why in heaven's name are you throwing them out of the school? Didn't understand it. So we looked at an alternative to doing that. And that's basically what this piece of legislation is all about. So I'll just briefly mention what we did in regard to it, and then I'll stand for questions. And simply it was this. That a school, when they committed a particular, let's say, violation of the rules, and the first thing that we would do is meet with the student in the principal's office. Secondly, we would call the parents and make an agreement with the parents that the parents should come in and sit with their child. We don't want the student out of school. We want the school in school because it is there that they can learn. The parents said, well, we're both working, so we cannot have any time. We can't get to school. Very fine. What we will have for you is we will have Saturday school. So school is going to be helped by having these students in school. And in this particular case, if the student was inappropriate in their behavior, if their parents could not come in with them, we would have Saturday school. Saturday school teaching that took place was very similar as in the classroom. The difference was is that they were the administrators. Then there was a third option. If, for example, parents said, well, we're not going to bring our kid in for Saturday school, then the third option was, and we had to make an agreement, and we had to inform our local judges in Dakota County. And so the judges heard our proposal and said, sounds pretty good. It's creative. We have many kids that do one thing wrong and they're immediately petitioned into the court system. And judges didn't know quite how to handle that situation because they thought it was a responsibility of the schools. And so the courts were also, and the judges were also, very positively in supporting of what we were doing. And so that's basically the essence of the bill. And I am before you on this committee simply because of the fact that there is a provision, as you look on line 23 of the bill, it talks about dollars per hour. And that's a funded situation. If school districts want to use this particular procedure, they can do that. By that I mean using the $54 per hour, or if this committee does not want to fund that particular provision, I can tell you that it was about 6 weeks, we had some of our teachers were willing to volunteer their time for Saturday school, to be quite frank with you. So if there isn't money for this particular proposal, at least I would hope that it would get due consideration as a solution to a problem that is not costing the state, not costing the school district, not costing the taxpayers any money at all, but it will solve problems. So, Madam Chair, I appreciate the opportunity. I appreciate time that you've given me this afternoon, and I want to say thank you to all the members.
Thank you, Representative Dempsey. We do have a quorum, and so the chair will move House File 512 before the committee to be laid over for consideration for possible inclusion in the final bill. I would like to ask you, Representative Dempsey, did most parents choose to attend school with their pupil for a day? Did that happen quite a bit?
Not as many as we would like. Although they were people that had confidence, I think, in the school. However, there were a great number of them in the district that just couldn't come because of the fact that they were both working. One of the things that we would do to kind of correct that was that we would let them know at to what point and at what time and what date they would be assigned to come to school. And so the numbers were quite a number because of the fact that we gave them some options, to be quite frank with you, as to possibly the one day. Some of the people were asked to come two, but in this particular bill we modified it to one. I don't have any records of that simply because they were not mine to manage. But the reception was very good, to be quite frank with you. And a lot of times, rather, and one of the things we would do in the school is that we would call the parents and tell them that if your son or daughter is a problem again, one of these issues might very well be what we'll have to implement. So you take your time, see to it that maybe you talk to your son or daughter in regard to what the consequences might be in the future if they repeat the inappropriate behavior. But it was well received by the citizenry of the district, to be quite frank. We had numbers, but the system worked. And the numbers, I can tell you, reduced. The numbers reduced, and teachers liked it as well.
We do have some questions for you, Representative. Yes. Representative Greiland.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Dempsey, I would like to commend you for looking for some alternative besides just having kids fail or be kicked out of school or whatever. I think it's a worthy goal. And I know that the funding source is always a problem for all of our worthy ideas around here. One question I wanted to ask you is, what kind of services are you trying to get from the juvenile court, or what are you trying to get at there with petitioning the court?
Mm-hmm. Well, what
Representative Dempsey.
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative. What we did is we spent a long period of time explaining to the judges, and we worked primarily with one, about what some suggestions might be that the court could use. And so we provided that information to them as to what we were going to try to do before, and then documentate that. And then if the third option was the only option that was left, then we had some options for the judges to choose from in discipline, so to speak, what would take place. And I can give you one example of some of those that we looked at. And that was the fact that the court could order the parent to Saturday school and put the responsibility for their child on the parent. Because most of the children are children, and they have to be treated as such in the eyes of the court. Some of the other things were is that the judge might assign. The judge might assign a particular job that maybe they could be working on a Saturday or during the week or after school or whatever else the case may be. In some instances, after school is out in the spring, some of the students were assigned to giving of time to the community, such as maybe sweeping the streets in a particular area. They might be assigned working with the work crew of the city or whatever else the case may be, so that there were a number of issues that the judge, using his own discretion, could utilize. And the judge, to be quite frank with you, came up with some very good ideas, and some of them were, I think, simply because they see things from a little bit different angle, and that is that they knew that the student and the parents had been warned on two previous occasions, and that they should have taken step one or step two to avoid something maybe a little more difficult and so on. So we tried to educate the judge and work with them in any way possible.
Representative Gemmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I first have a comment. Representative Dempsey, I appreciate what you're working on here. You obviously have a passion and for what you've done, and I think you've been very innovative in things you've been working on in your schools, and this is an example. I can't help but feel like I'm sitting on the school board again, talking about these issues, and I guess that's part of my comment. I guess I do have to say that, it's permissive to understand that I think we are dabbling a bit in what school boards maybe should be doing as opposed to maybe a committee here at the legislature. But I do have a question Representative Dempsey, the $54 per hour, is that intended to be for the time that supervisory people, school officials, the teachers, whatever, are with the kids during the suspension? Is that what you're looking for there when you say $54 per hour?
That's correct. And that number can be lowered, the number can be raised, or the number could be, the dollar amounts could be zero. Because the in the program we had, the principals were not paid. And we did have, after this system was in operation for about 6 weeks, we had six teachers that volunteered their time at no cost to the school district. So that was kind of good to see. Now, that might very well change if there is a contract written between the school board and the teachers union. And if that in fact is the case, go back to the point where have your administrators do the work, and it's no cost to anybody.
Representative Dimmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, that was one of my thoughts. Is I know in our school board contract with our teachers, there was some stipulation when you did out of the classroom and what the pay was, and this might might complicate that a bit, but it could be dealt with. How did you choose 54? Just out of curiosity, that particular number, did you just pick it, or?
That's correct.
Okay.
I guess what the reason why I picked that particular number was basically because teachers generally don't work on Saturdays. Not many. Some people do, and some people don't. And some of the people, when they work overtime, they get time and a half for their dollars and so on, and their costs. For some of the teachers, it might be 15, 18, 20 miles from the school or driving in and so on, and so there's some costs and so on. And so that those costs, I thought, would be covered by that particular number of 54. I believe it is that, is it not? Yeah, $54.
Okay, thanks.
Seeing no other questions?
Madam Chair, just one other point.
Sure.
Okay, one other point. I would, in regard to this particular bill, some of you may be interested in it, you may not be, I don't know, but one of the problems that you might come into contact with, and that is the implementation of the bill. How do you implement this particular solution to the problem? And the same thing is true with some of the other programs, and I'll just mention those to you now, to be quite frank with you. But as I mentioned to you, we had a slogan in our school that everybody is somebody in our school. Everybody is somebody, and you don't throw somebody that's worth something out on the street. I don't think you do. And if you're somebody, you're treated as somebody. So that was a thing that worked on our looking at solutions to problems that didn't cost any money and not putting kids' schools out of school. We also had the GROW program, and I'm not going to take my time to explain to you that program, but it was a recognition one, and it wasn't an incentive for kids to learn, an incentive, and it worked. And what GROW stood for is grades, rise, opportunities, widen, grow. And I can tell you about that program sometime if you want to hear about it. It solved problems, okay? Third one was the announcement program that we had. When you have announcements at the beginning of the day in your schools, and we changed that particular process because it wasn't working. And so we proposed a solution to that problem, and we did, and that didn't cost the school district or the taxpayers one red nickel. And so we had that particular program. We also had evaluation of teachers. A lot of school districts, and you can ask your students, how many times did the principal come to your office in your local school? And I think it might be, to be honest with you, it might be less than...
Representative Dempsey, I think you meant the classroom.
In the classroom, I'm sorry. Okay. I'm getting a little, and I'm getting a little louder in my speech, and I shouldn't do that too, Madam Chair, so thank you for the correction. But we did evaluate our teachers, and in a very positive way. It was not negative, it was positive, just as we do with kids at school, and so on. So those are some other programs that will solve problems for school. We had a problem in the school. Sometimes kids weren't eating the hot lunch program, so we had to solve that problem because we couldn't raise the prices. Couldn't raise the prices. We just did smarter stuff in the cafeteria and so on. So those are some of the things that we did, and I appreciate the opportunity for making a presentation today. And if you think any of that has worthwhile and you want me to help you on either an individual basis or whatever, I'm more than willing to do that. And if you don't care to do that, I understand that as well. So, Madam Chair, thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Dempsey. And the bill will be laid over for possible consideration in the omnibus bill. And we will move on to House File 616. And that's Representative Clemzig. Would you like to move your bill, Representative Clemzig? And I believe you have an author's amendment as well.
Yes, ma'am. Yes, Madam Chair. I would like to move my House File 616 for consideration for the Finance Committee. Thanks. I do have an author's amendment. It keeps the intent of the bill fairly similar, but makes it more voluntary, less of an all-out mandate. Before I go through that, I just want to give then a brief statement about kind of the philosophy of the concept and the kind of where it came from. Most of us in the education field, especially those of us who've been teachers in the classroom, kind of know this anecdotally, but also research strongly suggests that the most important variable that determines student success in the class is the classroom instruction, and it's their experience in the classroom that really has the biggest effect on their outcome and their student achievement. So the rationale behind this is that if the majority of the expenditures are being done in the regular classroom, then we can expect student achievement gains. So it directs additional money, a small amount, to some pilot programs, some pilot sites that would volunteer to be part of this program, to commit to 65% of their expenditures going to regular classroom instruction. The state average currently, you can see on the UFARS coding, UFARS Uniform Financial, I guess I don't know what it stands for exactly, but it is the way that we track expenditures and revenues. I don't know the acronym. Maybe Mr. Strom, you can give us what the acronym is or means.
Mr. Strom.
Uniform Financial and Accounting Reporting Standards.
Okay. Thank you. But basically, it's 12. Thank you. It's 12 categories that school districts put their expenditures into, and it's supposed to be a uniform reporting system to allow the state to be able to look at how schools and school districts are reporting their, how they are spending their money. And it also does the same reporting for the revenue, so where is the money coming from? So on the expenditures sheet, if you want to look at the state average for what is spent on regular classroom instruction, if you go to the last page, it'll show you for the state that average is 47.65%. There's also in your packet, I believe, a list of the definitions of what regular instruction is. This includes elementary and secondary classroom instruction, but it does not include vocational instruction. The definition says it does not include exceptional instruction. However, it does include things like ELL, gifted and talented, extracurriculars, and that sort of thing is included in this category. So the exceptional instruction that is not included in the category is special ed. However, in talking to some districts, I do know that sometimes they do code their expenditures for some special ed students if that kid is getting services directly in the mainstream. An example is when I was teaching a class that was a regular social studies class, but it had half special ed students in it. We did have a para in that classroom. The para was not coded special ed. That para was coded as a regular instruction expense. So this does not necessarily distinguish all of the special ed expenses as not part of the regular instruction piece. So this means that of the 47% being spent on regular classroom instruction, means there's another 35% being spent on special ed. And then on support services, if you combine support services for the district and school administration, for district support services, instructional support services, pupil support services, in those categories, it's 16.75% of support money expenditures on the support services. So I just wanted to point out that data is in your packet to look at. What the pilot project would do is provide for six different school sites or districts to volunteer to participate, to make that commitment to try to spend 65% of their dollars on the regular classroom instruction category. And for that, they get a small bump in their expenses to try to help them bridge that gap if they're going to need to make a major change. The 2% of their regular instruction budget from the previous year, that would be the small bump, the incentive to get the schools interested in the program. There might be some waivers needed in times because we, as was stated by the former legislators up here, sometimes put mandates on districts across the state for where the money needs to go. I mean, we do it all the time.
Current legislators would never do that.
No, I meant the previous legislators stated that we did it. And I was just saying, yes, we do that. And so in some cases, the districts might say, this is impossible because of, you know, X mandate which exists, which won't let me put 65% of my expenditures towards that regular classroom instruction. So given that, there is a piece in this amendment that would allow the commissioner to hook the district up with some of the mandate relief initiatives that we've passed. We passed some waivers for model or for people who want to be pilots, for other waiver initiatives from mandates. And so this would allow the commissioner to hook them up with those particular pilot projects as well.
Do you wish to, would you explain your amendment? I mean, you have sort of explained your amendment, but would you like to move your amendment, I guess?
Okay, I'll move the amendment now before the, it's amendment H0616DE2 before the committee.
Is there further discussion of the amendment or any questions about the amendment? Okay, hearing none, all those in favor of the amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Amendment is adopted. Proceed. Did you have witnesses that you wish to bring up?
Yeah, I do. There is one letter of testimony from B.J. Miller who supported this since it was first introduced in the 2003 session in your packet. And then I also have Ms. Carrington here to also give, she's a school board member who would like to explain why she supports the bill.
Please come up, Ms. Carrington. And if there's anybody else here who would like to testify on this bill, you are welcome to do so after Ms. Carrington.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the Education Policy Committee. I appreciate the opportunity to talk to you. I am Laura Carrington, and actually in 1999 I retired from a 31-year full-time teaching career, and then in January of this year I began my second term as a Morris Area School Board member. So I now serve on our school district's finance committee and was recently elected as our school district's treasurer. My interest in testifying today stems from my concern that increased spending for education in the past did not bring a resultant increase in student achievement. Representative Klinzing's bill to require 65% of education monies to go to K through 12 regular ed instruction provides an attempt to address that problem and appeals to me for several other reasons as well. And I'm going to address four of those reasons. One is, even though school districts must report their expenditures to the state according to distinct categories, as Representative Klinzing pointed out, school board members often do not see that breakdown. And when we're given a line-by-line system at the board meetings, it's very difficult sometimes to evaluate a budget objectively. So we need to be cognizant of how much money is actually going into regular ed classroom instruction where students get their basic education. So I appreciate that we probably might maybe see that a little more often at our meetings. And I've been pressing for that for some time. Let's see this by category at our meetings, and we don't always do that. So I'm hoping that this might raise some awareness to school board members so they know where their money's going, because it is their job to know. And then the second item is that with this same UFAR's current reporting tool, schools can see how their spending changes from year to year as well. And I think pilot schools could set the tone to see if the 65% guideline for classroom instruction would help get more careful monitoring of budgets, instill more ingenuity, and prevent overspending in areas like administration or transportation or others. And then three is, the bill also indirectly addresses a growing problem in today's educational process, and that, I believe, is the increased labeling of students as LD, Title I, EBD, ADHD, all special ed categories. I think the best basic skills instruction should always be in the least restrictive environment, which is still the classroom, and individualized instruction in the regular ed setting still needs to be looked at again. And this legislation could promote using qualified special ed teachers more for direction, teacher pairing, and other creative ways to deal with our special ed students. And I think we need to start looking at some of those things that help them out a little more than we have been, probably with the methods we always use, sometimes use now. And the fourth is, the effect of new school construction in school districts is being cited more and more as having lasting budget problems. In that aspect of education spending, as Representative Klinzing also pointed out, is not included in the current state report. And I believe it needs to be factored in as a part of the total operating expenses. This yearly repayment of bond and operating levy debt has increased and made some very high local taxes, which negatively affects the passage of future operating levies. And I know that we've been told, you know, that we can go out and get some extra money with an excess levy referendum, but it's hard to do that when we already have the high bond issue referendums out there taking up our eating up the taxes. And so, and the other reason is because new schools often have similar or higher maintenance costs over the older, often structurally sound, historically significant buildings that are replaced. That all makes a difference in how we look at the finance situation as well, and I don't know if we're addressing that. So then I'll just close with this last little reminder, and kind of comes from some of the experiments that were mentioned earlier, like profile learning and that type of thing. But when we sidetrack from our students' academic and educational needs, it's just gone on way too long, and it's time to focus on the students' right to learn a basic curriculum, with teachers having the right and responsibility to teach it. And I thank you very much. And certainly.
Are there questions for Ms. Harrington? She is on the school board in Morris, Minnesota. So I guess I would just ask Ms. Harrington, is your district doing anything differently that would, you know, maybe head toward this direction of more money in the classroom?
I think the main things that we are doing are probably, you know, having some of us, a few of us on the board anyway, that direct, always say, you know, let's look at, you know, what does not affect the time in the classroom, you know, and the education system when we're looking at budget adjustments. I always hesitate to call them budget cuts because, to me, it's adjustments, and we should be looking at them as the things that the students, what the students need in the school system and the education that they get from the teachers. And instead of just looking at them as cuts, I think adjustments can be made a lot of times without looking at cutting classroom instruction. So I guess mostly that way. Also, just the fact that I'm trying to get our superintendent to show us how all of our expenditures and revenue fit into the UFAR's reporting system. And we are making some progress in that area as well.
All right. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Representative Fish,
thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, and Ms. Cedar, too, Representative Quinzing or Mr. Strom might be able to help me with this. So I looked through this UFAR's coding spreadsheet. The one column I noticed that has the greatest variation in expenditures appears to be the capital expenditures. I'm looking at Nobles County, for instance. You have one school district that lists capital expenditures at almost, over 34% of the budget, and a neighboring school district in which capital expenditures are at 1.58%. And I look through the spreadsheet, and over again, those differences appear. Does that point out, Representative Quinzing, that the uniform financial accounting system may not be as uniform as it probably should ought to be, or is that more, throw that out there, or is that more an indication of particular circumstances that have to do with deferred maintenance and time to catch up and things like that? Could you help me understand why the fluctuation, if you know?
Madam Chair, I'm going to let
Representative Clinton.
I do want to give an answer to that, but first let Mr. Strom address it.
Madam Chair, Representative Clinton.
Mr. Strom.
I think one of the points that Ms. Carrington made that's important to keep in mind is what you see on the spreadsheet in front of you is what we call the general fund total expenditures. It does not include building debt, which is the amount that's used to repay building bonds. And one of the results of that is sometimes you'll see that some school districts are doing a lot of building activity or a fair amount of building activity through their capital account, which is actually part of the general fund, whereas other school districts may be doing almost all of their capital spending through the debt service fund, through the sale of new bonds. For example, if a school district had just recently passed a bond issue, they may do all of their remodeling work through the sale of bonds as well as doing some of that in the capital account. So my guess is that the reason that there's a tremendous difference there for that one district is because of some particular capital project during that year that was not done through bonds, but was rather done through the capital account.
Mr. Strom, wouldn't that mean that they're taking a lot of money away from what should be working for students, or... Yes. Would this be a one-year thing, or would this be an ongoing thing?
Madam Chair, without knowing details about the district, my guess is it's a one-year blip. But what some school districts do is they sell, we allow by statute a district to sell a capital note that's repaid with general education money. And there may have been that the expenditures out of the capital fund in that year reflected that whole amount being spent in one year. And then in subsequent years, there'd be a transfer from the undesignated general fund to the capital account to repay those notes. I'm not sure if that's what's going on without knowing the details of that district. But in general, when that happens, it's a separate funding stream so that the district's not spending money that would otherwise be available for operating purposes. It's money that would only be available for capital purposes.
Madam Chair.
Representative Biskin.
Madam Chair, and I thank you, Mr. Strom, for that that information, but I will point out that it's not just one district. If you go through the spreadsheet time and time again, you'll see districts bumping up to or jumping over the 20% of their budget going to capital expenditures. I probably count very quickly close to a dozen, if not two dozen, if I would take the time. So it's not just a one-time anomaly. I mean, there is a one-time anomaly that I found in here where one district was actually spending negative 12.9% in their capital expenditures, and I didn't even bother asking about that one. I will get to that. But again, over and over again, you'll see them bumping up close to or around 20%, and so if it was one school thing, I guess I wouldn't be as concerned, but maybe Representative Clancy, your thoughts?
Representative Clancy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First, I just want to say that given that 78% of the district's revenues are coming from the state, I do think it's important for us to have some sort of uniform accounting system so that the state, as it's deciding how much in revenues it needs to give, that it has some sort of basis on which to make that decision. And I think that the districts, to the best of their ability, are trying to code these things given the definitions that they have. And there is a slightly more detailed list of definitions that unfortunately you don't have in your packet, but is available from the departments, and we can get that to you if you want it. But even as I've been researching this bill and listening to comments, I've become aware of the fact that different districts may code things differently. Now, there is some consistency in the categories, and you can kind of see some of the categories don't have a lot of jumping around in terms of how much one district spends versus another. And actually, the regular instruction category is kind of one of those that tends to be have a smaller range. But I think there needs to be some work done in helping districts use the uniform coding system, and some work might need to be done in terms of defining it. But I do think that given that districts are trying to the best of their ability, code these things, and for the most part, in general terms, this is where the classroom instruction, the regular classroom instruction, and plus the other things I mentioned, like ELL and extracurriculars and gifted and talented fall. It's still amazing to me that less than half of the budget is spent there on average, especially now that we, parent too, that does not include the debt service piece. And in terms of the negative 12%, I know of one district that's borrowing out of their capital fund, and that might be why they're at a negative 12% there.
Representative Greiling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to compliment the school board member, Ms. Carrington, for her work. It's hard to be a school board member. A lot of us around this table at one time were. And I hope you'll keep on with your quest to get the information in a way that you want it from the superintendent so you can understand it, because that's always a continuing dialogue with school board members, so trying to understand what's going on. Representative Clancy and or Ms. Carrington, with my question, I think it's an ideal goal in an ideal world if we had 65% of the funding that schools have being used for instruction. We have so many other calls on the dollar. And I'm glad that you have a pilot so we can, districts that choose can do this, because I think it would be unworkable if they all had to do it, because we, one of the ways to have more money spent on instruction would be to have more money for schools. If you had a bigger pot, then some of the constants, that are always there that districts have to do would shrink in comparison to the pot. I noticed that not a single district makes the 65% threshold. The only one that comes closest is Bellingham with 64.42, and Wayzata and Morris are 51 and 52. So it'll be interesting to see if any districts are able to apply for this. And my one concern about the bill is if we're giving state money, or I shouldn't say my one concern, but a big concern, if we're giving state money to districts if it isn't, you know, some districts, because of the nature of whoever lives in their district, have larger special ed populations than others, and you'd be rewarding districts that happen to be lucky enough to not have seriously ill students within their boundaries. And I wonder if we want to be, if that's a anything that districts can control, to be rewarding.
Madam Chair.
Representative Clemson.
Yeah, given that least restrictive environment is really the goal of the Special Education IDEA Act, and that knowing that a lot of districts do code those kids who are in the mainstream as much as possible into the regular instruction part of the bill, I don't see this as a punishment on those districts that might have slightly higher special ed populations. Also, really 37% of the budget, if you take special ed out, there's still another 37% of the budget for which to look for changes. And so it doesn't have to be a special ed versus regular ed debate. I really think that since there is a good, that this can be achieved by doing the best by special education students and not affecting them necessarily nor punishing districts that might have a lot of special education students. And in fact, I've worked in a district where they got audited and it was found that least restrictive environment was not being used as much and they had to start moving students back into more of the mainstream. And I think there might be a place for some districts to start considering that more.
Well, we have three more questioners on the list here, and then we'll move on. Representative Heidbergen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Clemson, I sign on the bill, and it's a good bill. And it's something that I think that you requested last year already to have a hearing on, and we've been sitting here. And you had patience, and you pursued it again, and it's a number that oftentimes is thrown around in the education world, especially when they compare states. Minnesota ranks 48th in the nation on money spent in the classroom. So this, we're way behind the rest of the country in addressing the problem that you're trying to address. I like the bill, and the only thing that I would draw exception to would be the vocational instruction end of it. In my district, we have a lot of students that return back to their district to work, and whether it be ag-related or industrial arts, or they come over and take over a body shop, or they take over. These are all skilled people. And I think the state of Minnesota has gone in the right direction by not allowing only four-year students that want to go on a four-year college to enroll in the different programs that we have, but we also, they can also now go to the vocational schools as well. We recognize the need for skills. But there's where I would draw an exception. I would like to see, especially if you go out and you do the drops of the rural schools, you're going to see that they have a higher percentage of vocational instruction because of the number of students in industrial arts or number of students in ag or number of students that are signing up for those particular fields. And I think that that needs to be an important component because we're... if you pick up the papers, if you're looking at openings for employment, at least in our state, they cannot find enough people to work in farm machinery. They cannot find enough people to work mechanics or diesel mechanics. All those places have got a long, long line of people that they just don't have enough people that have these skills. And I think, Ms. Carrington, you might want to comment on it. In Morris area, I know that. That area as well, there's usually the openings that are available are in those skilled areas. And I think that's something that we perhaps might want to look at. But I think we got a real good bill here. I'd just like to see the vocational aspect, at least part of vocational, come in there, whether it be industrial arts and ag. And it wouldn't be that many, but because we do have the gifted in there, and we need the other, because these people are gifted in a different area. But just your comments on that.
Okay. Madam Chair?
Yes. Ms. Carrington.
Yes, I agree with you on vocational instruction, and it is one of the line items on the UFARS report. And I do know that, you know, school districts that are looking at adjustments sometimes look at vocational to cut. And in fact, we are dealing with that in Morris right now because we have a very experienced, very excellent industrial arts teacher that is retiring this year. And there's talk, you know, about not rehiring them. We already have people in our industrial part of the community that you refer to that are already saying, you know, hopefully, you will not cut your industrial arts program because of that. But I do think, yeah, it may be something, you know, to consider or put in that they could call as part of the regular ed instruction even, I think. That'd be my way of looking at it. And just one of the responses in regard to the special ed question that was asked also is that I think I referred to that in my original comments, that I think it's time that we looked at special ed in getting kids back into, you know, the least restrictive environment, which is their regular ed room, and maybe using our special ed teachers in a different way. And I just don't think it is a conflict either. I agree with Representative Quincy on that. So I appreciate the opportunity to answer those questions.
All right.
Madam Chair.
Representative Clinton.
In the more very, very specific list of what is included, industrial education is included in this particular category. Vocational education is defined slightly differently from industrial.
Okay.
So this would include your industrial tech types of classes.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Representative Meslow.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Clinton. I like the concept of what you're trying to get at here, and I particularly appreciate the amendment and taking a look at this as a pilot, because this has a lot of other implications, and rather than forcing this on school districts, I like the idea of providing it as an opportunity and an incentive to have districts take a look at this and try it out so we see where it's headed. And I think creativity is part of what we want to try to do. Within that, as I've been listening to your discussion, to Ms. Carrington's testimony, my impression is that it would be a sub-goal of this to encourage participating districts to use more of the resources that are going in special ed in mainstreaming type opportunities in the classroom, that we want to encourage those districts to have the special education students in the classroom with the other students rather than pullouts. Do you see that as kind of a sub-goal of the bill?
Representative Clinton.
Representative Meslow, I don't know that it's necessarily a sub-goal. However, it could be a potential effect in some cases, not necessarily a negative one, mm-hmm. given, you know, the rationale, or I guess the philosophy behind the IDEAS Act. I guess my intent initially was not to put regular ed against special ed, but I think people zero in on that because it's a large part of the budget, 16%. However, just there is a large other part of the budget, 37%. So, but I do I do need to comment and answer on what I do think foresee happening to some of the special ed. And again, having worked in a district that was audited and found we weren't providing least restrictive environments, my experience has been that, yes, that is what occurred with some of the classes we had to set up in order to try to provide those opportunities for those kids.
If I might, Madam Chair.
Representative Meslow.
Thank you. Representative Clinton, thank you. Yeah, it just strikes me that that's an area where a district might have more flexibility, and that's why it struck me as something that would be a possible positive or negative outcome. Again, because we're talking about a pilot that gives districts the opportunity to take a look at that. My other question was, in setting the bar at 65%, was there a magic to picking that number? And I would actually ask if that number is maybe a little higher than we want it to be, if we want to be encouraging districts to come online. But if you can give me an idea of what the thinking is behind 65%, I'd appreciate that.
Representative Plunging.
No real magic, I suppose, although there wasn't necessarily accounting behind it either, other than when I was looking into it, there have been a lot of questions from my district about how much is spent on the regular classroom instruction from folks who saw other services that are provided by the school. They want to know how much is going towards those services versus how much is going towards directly into the classroom for the teachers and the supplies and such. So in looking into it, I discovered the 47% number and I was surprised that it was less than half. So last year I came out with a bill that would make it a little more than half. I set it at 55, thinking, you know, that's a, you know, reasonable leap. And it was amazing the number of people said, why are you only setting it at 55? These are people who didn't realize that we spend 47%. I think common knowledge to some of the constituents I was working with was that we were spending at least 65, 70, 80 on this. And so I bumped it up to thinking that, I mean, if people, you know, who are in business and look at budgets for a living are surprised that we're spending less than half, think it should be 65, kind of where we set it. Now, it is somewhat of a negotiable, any number is negotiable, but I haven't seen any testimony yet really about why it should be less or more.
Thank you.
Representative Dorn.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I do appreciate the general thrust of the bill. I think we always want to identify if we are spending each dollar as effectively as we can and make the right choices in prioritization. I appreciate the discussion, and my question is probably turned mostly into a comment at this stage in terms of the discussion, but I will admit that in my own thinking over the years, I've kind of just come to the conclusion that the UFARS categories are what accountants have to do in order to follow some kinds of rules to report some things. I've just always lumped instruction as instruction. So I've considered that if it's a student whose needs are being met by a teacher, whether it occurs in a classroom where a few of the most difficult EBD students are working with the teacher, that to me is still instruction. Or if it's a student in the regular classroom, I'll admit I would have trouble sorting it out, because even if we are labeling more LD, EBD, ADHD, ADD, whatever, it seems like a lot of them come into the classroom for part of their day and they're in a separate room, classroom, for part of their day. I think I had about 25 students last semester who were either had an IEP or a 504 or whatever. They weren't always in a regular classroom. So I can see the confusion that must occur in terms of how to report and track all of this. So I think that's going to be, you know, part of the challenge of this and figuring out, you know, how to count how much of the student, which way, to do this. What I would not want us to see, and maybe the pilot program would show us that, is that we would get ourselves involved having someone measuring exactly how to define and track all of this, that we would end up using resources out of the classroom in order to do the measuring that we want to avoid, because we thought the dollar would be better spent with someone working with students. I go back to, and I missed last night's Capital Forum presentation because I had constituents and the meeting lasted longer, but Dr. Rucci, I think, made the point in his first one that one of the difficulties large districts face is so much difficulty being tracking specifically categorized dollars that states send in terms of school districts' needs, that they oftentimes have to have one person for each category who does nothing but make sure they're receiving it correctly and expending it appropriately and are able to document it accurately, so that they can keep all of this going. It was one of his arguments, I thought, for more site-based management. But again, any way we can get a handle on what's happening is I think good. But those were kind of my thoughts as I heard the discussion. So I share them for whatever they are worth.
Thank you, Representative Dorn. We actually have somebody else who would like to make a few comments.
While they're coming down, Madam Chair, just to respond to Representative
Ms. Schwab. Go ahead. Go ahead, Representative Clinton.
And I also heard Dr. Oates speak, and I was at that presentation and read his book. I also don't know that he'd say that in that those dollars, I mean, he does think the dollars should be funneled directly to the site.
Yeah.
And be used as much as possible for that school site, and really made a big argument for decentralization. So I think he'd be a little surprised at the district support service expenditures that are being made, and just the support service expenditures across the board, which if you total them all up are around 16% range. So I don't know how, and we are already tracking all that information and I guess having those conundrums about how to tabulate things. So I think it's a good point you made, and thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Schwab.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Grace Schwab with the Minnesota School Boards Association. I want to take a moment to compliment Representative Plensing. Her bill is a wonderful bill, and as I read it, I thought, this is exactly what we want to have happen in our schools. She hit it right on the money. Putting the dollars where the kids are the best thing you can do. As we started to research it to try and figure out definitions and what they mean, she hits two perfect in her bill. The one we have trouble with is actually the regular instruction piece. And I'm not sure an accounting model is the best way to define dollars spent in a classroom. For example, where some of the confusion I have, I just pulled the index of UFARS just to take a look at that 200 category where the regular instruction is done. And under that category, you'll find industrial education, as Representative Plensing said. But as you look on to the 300, you'll find agricultural education, distributive education, health occupations. So to me, that's not very clear what's in and what's out. Also, under the 200, you'll find co-curriculars. You know, I just would hope that as we go forward with this project, we spend a little time to make sure we're asking for the codes that goes in there. And we feel as an organization, the special education piece, we do throughout the school day, and that's education. We provide regular education to special needs students in a special way to students. So we really think that needs to be, and especially the vocational piece, too. As Representative Thorne mentioned, and Representative Pikerkin, it's key to a lot of our rural school districts. So that's my only comments on the bill. And once again, we're thrilled with the waivers, because as you look at this, special ed, transportation, I just started to write them down. School lunch, staff development are all set aside, or we need some kind of money in those areas we have to spend. So the waiver for this vision was a stroke of genius. Because truly, that will help us get there. And we're excited that it's a targeted program to a small group so we can see how it goes. But it's just some of those definitional issues. If we could be a little bit more clear, it would be great. Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you, Representative Plensing. Your bill will be laid over for possible inclusion in the final bill. And at this point, we have Representative Greiling's bill. And while she and her people are coming up, I'd like to remind you, those of you who didn't remember, we had a Capitol forum last night. There is, and not many people remembered, Representative Dorn, you weren't alone, and I meant to mention it yesterday, and, you know, we got to the end of the meeting, we were kind of rushed, and I forgot. But next Wednesday night, it's on improving classroom instruction. You know, something that I think is of interest to many of us. So, you know, if you can fit it into your schedule, I know what schedules are looking like these days. If you can fit it in, I'd suggest that you try to go. Lauren Resnick is the speaker, and she's with the Institute of Learning at the University of Pittsburgh. And that's, again, 6 to 7 in the evening. I got there last night. I had to leave a little bit early, though, so all that interesting data, I never quite learned the why it was the way it was. And they were presenting data on why actually high school kids are learning less than they did 15 years ago, which is pretty scary, actually. So, Representative Greiling, would you care to move your bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, I would move House File 195.
All right. And you have no amendments, correct?
Madam Chair, that is correct.
So would you like to briefly explain your bill, and then we'll hear from your witnesses.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This bill, those who are on this committee last year will recall from last year, it's a bill for school districts like St. Anthony New Brighton, a including the testifiers, are all from that district here today, where they have an exceptionally high percentage of open enrollment students. St. Anthony New Brighton is a wonderful small district that's been very successful with school choice, and but yet the money that comes with levy referendums, that that aid does not follow the students from the resident district. So that creates a problem when you have a lot of open enrollment students. So Representative Strom has come up with a formula. You can read your bill for yourself, but it's a way to partially compensate on a kind of a sliding fee scale based on how many open enrollment students you have. And it's funded by the commercial, industrial, and seasonal home tax, property tax, and I know that we'll have some people who are not thrilled about that funding source and will tell us, but I believe they support the bill. And so, you know, I'm open to changing the funding source to the general fund, like the two bills that we just heard, if that's more acceptable to the committee, so that we can focus on the bill. But I didn't bring an amendment to that effect. At this time, I'd like to introduce the superintendent of St. Anthony New Brighton Schools, Dr. Bob Duncan. And he is over on the far left. Mike Volna, who's the school board chair, is on my left. And Jackie Rolfe, who is the chair of the Blue Ribbon Committee that you may have been receiving letters from and may get some more from. So you might want to take a close look at Jackie to my right, but she's responsible for that, along with Leah Slyle. Am I pronouncing it? Sly, I'm sorry. And oh, you're the one on my right. Okay, there's Leah and there's Jackie. They got me mixed up now. And they are both active volunteers and advocates for their school. So I'll be quiet and let you hear from them.
Well, my name is Bob Duncan, Superintendent of Schools in St. Anthony, New Brighton.
Well.
And Madam Chair and members of the committee, thank you for your time to hear us out. We are an example of a school district that there are other across the state, that the present flow of revenue for parent choice doesn't support it, and particularly in the area of open enrollment. We're a district of 1,735 students in K through 12, and our enrollment for next year will have 925 of those students will be resident students, and 810 of those students will be non-resident students. And we will, right now we have around 70 students on the waiting list, and if past trends hold true, we'll probably have close to 100 by this summer. Those students will not be able to accept in our district because we do not have the physical space to put them. We do not market our school at all in any spending any money marketing. Our reputation is based on word of mouth and our reputation as a school with academic rigor, and that we're a caring and safe school, and that we're a small school. As mentioned by Representative Grayling, we do not receive any money on these students from the operating levy. And in order to generate enough money then to cover the next year 810 non-resident students that we get, our own taxpayers have voted to maximize our operating levy. And so that's based on 925 resident students. So we have to then spread that money across the 1735. And we feel that since parent choice is a policy and of the state of Minnesota, that the funding should be there to support districts that are successful at it and not be a detriment. With that, I'll turn it over to our board chair, Mike Bolnap.
Madam Chair, members of the committee.
Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Bolnap. Chairman of the district board.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. My name is Michael Volna. I am the chair of the St. Anthony New Brighton School District School Board. I am a graduate of St. Anthony New Brighton Schools, born and raised there, and except for a few years when I was going to college. I've lived in either New Brighton end of the district or in St. Anthony all of my life. We are historically a very good school district. We have very high academic standards. For example, in 2004, on a graduating class of 130 kids, we had 5 national merit commended and 5 national merit finalists for as National Merit Scholars, which is probably the highest percentage in the state. We were one of only a handful of school districts, high schools, that were a double five-star rating last year. We were one of only five schools in the state to score at or above 90% on both MCA tests last year. Our middle school in 1996 was named a Blue Ribbon School of Excellence. We are the reigning state knowledge bowl champions in the large school district class, even though we are pretty small. And 2 weeks ago, our team won the science bowl championships for the state, and we'll be representing Minnesota at the national. We have historically had small class sizes. We have, as Dr. Duncan said, a very caring environment, a safe environment. We are one of the founding members of WEMEP, and we have won the School Matches What Parents Want Award for 7 straight years. So I think that by all measures, we are we have, if not maybe built a better mousetrap, we've got a pretty good mousetrap. I've been on the board for about 15 years, and the board in the early 90s made a conscious policy decision to embrace and adopt open enrollment. At that time, we were a district that, like many inner-ring districts, was experiencing declining resident enrollment. We saw many benefits to that. We have big districts around us, Roseville, Moundsview, Columbia Heights, Minneapolis. We saw it as an opportunity to increase our student base, which provides greater opportunities for programs, to utilize excess capacity, to provide additional revenues, obviously, through the transfer of the basic foundation aid. And what we have found over time is it really has provided opportunities for both the students coming in and the students that are here as residents. As Dr. Duncan said, we in the last 12 years have gone from just a trickle to about 45% open enrollment. The cutoff for this year, this coming year's open enrollment was February 15th, and at that point we measured we had 219 additional applicants over and above the kids already here. And we have accepted about 150 of them, so that leaves you a waiting list. Basically, parents come here because they want this district. They like this district. As a board, though, we've had to make some policy choices as well in terms of finances. And as we've looked at this, we've realized that we receive less revenues on open enrollment kids than we do on resident kids. The basic foundation formula comes, but the excess levies and some of the compensatory aids don't. As Dr. Duncan said, that requires us to make choices about how we tax and how we spread those revenues across the whole student population. From a policy perspective, we think open enrollment has been a huge success. I mean, we embrace it. We think that most districts would tell you it's been a good thing educationally and it's been a good thing for the students. But the questions are, does the state really intend districts to be competitive only up to a point? Does the state really only intend that when you get too successful, you are economically penalized by that? Open enrollment up to this point has focused what I would call on the demand side, make students, give students choice so that they can make choices. I don't think the funding has focused on the supply side. Are districts capable of providing the choice that may be out there? So in conclusion, we appreciate the time. I very much appreciate your support. We think this bill goes a long way towards addressing the inequities and the unintended consequences of open enrollment funding, and I would ask for your support. Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Thank you, sir. Are there oh, you wanted to speak. Go ahead.
Thank you. My name is Jackie Rolfe. I'm a parent with students in the St. Anthony New Brighton district. And until a few months ago, I didn't know anything about education finance, except that we seem to be cutting budgets all the time. Last fall, I was asked to be part of a citizen-based task force that was looking at the finances in our district. And that's when I learned that current school finance laws actually disadvantage districts like ours that attract a large number of open enrollment, students. Open enrollment is about choices. It's about choices that parents make. It's about choices that school districts make. It's about choices that you as legislators make in trying to set good public policy for the state. We chose the St. Anthony New Brighton District for our children when we bought our first house 11 years ago. Our daughter was 2, and we researched 6 or 7 school districts in the metro area, and we very quickly decided that St. Anthony New Brighton was the best game in town because it had the high academic standards that we were looking for and a nurturing environment that we thought would set our kids up for success. When our daughter was 4, we were thrown a little bit of a curveball because her preschool teacher suggested that we look at a school outside of our district. And we did that. And we had that option because of open enrollment. And we very much appreciated that choice. In the end, St. Anthony de Brighton Schools won out. It's been a great district for her. It was a good district for our daughter when she was 5, and it's a good district for her now that she's 13. But loyalty does not keep us in the district. And with all due respect to our superintendent and our school board chair, if St. Anthony did not provide the education that we needed for our kids, we would be out in a second looking for another alternative. Our school district knows that, and that affects the choices that they make. It makes our schools accountable to the parents. As a district, I think St. Anthony New Brighton has done everything that the state has asked. You've heard some of the statistics. We deliver results. Our test scores are among the best in the state. 90% of our students go on to pursue post-secondary education. This year, as you've heard, we had a huge number of National Merit Scholars. But the best indicator of our success is that open enrollment figure. Parents around the metropolitan area are choosing our district because we deliver. Neighboring districts are closing schools because of declining enrollment. We have a waiting list. We have shown that we can compete with the best schools in the state, and we can win. And I think that's what open enrollment is supposed to be about. It's supposed to improve public education for everybody by asking our schools to compete. The schools compete, the parents choose the best, and everybody wins. Everybody tries harder. But our current finance laws aren't supporting the model because the money isn't following the successes. And we are, in fact, in our current model, penalizing the best schools in the state, like ours. We can't fix this at the local level. We are maxed out at our levy. You've heard from Bob. We can't. Our levy is capped based on our resident students. The levy money that an open enrolled student gets in their own district doesn't follow them when they come to our district. That's not fair. And if that sort of inequity continues, our district is not going to be able to continue to provide the educational choices that parents like me and others in our district appreciate. Because of budget cuts, we have already had to cut our school day by one class period, which means our kids have fewer choices and have a harder time getting the course requirements that they need to fulfill college admission requirements. And, you know, what message would it send to the school districts in the state if one of the best schools in the state, by any measure, couldn't continue to provide a quality education because the state has some inequalities in its funding? So as a parent and as a taxpayer, my question to you is this. Why don't school finance laws support the policies that underlie the open enrollment option? Why don't we reward our schools when they succeed? Now, the bill you have in front of you won't totally fill the gap. There's still going to be less revenue, and revenue that we have to figure out a way to make up and figure out a way to close. But the bill lessens the gap, and if you pass this bill, you will be sending a message to every school district in the state and to every parent in the state that, in fact, Minnesota does support school choice, and, in fact, we will support the schools that can prove that they can succeed educationally.
Thank you very much, Ms. Rawls. We're going to go to questions now. Representative Hyde Gerken.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I kind of figured this would be coming up, and it's an issue that's been brought to the table before. I, for one, am against open enrollment. I've seen what it's done out in rural Minnesota. Regional centers can levy. They levy 2%. They get a lot of money. You get out in rural area after the 201 tax reform bill, and we took all ag land and all the property along the lakes, the cabins off of a referenda. Obviously, we can't levy like St. Anthony can. What you basically are asking to do, the purpose is equal access, you said open enrollment. But the purpose you're trying to accomplish would be doing the opposite. You're creating haves and have-nots. Right now, I would love that. Wouldn't it be better to allow districts to equal levy abilities? Let's establish a statewide tax program. Take all the taxes in the entire state of Minnesota, divide it up by the number of kids. And in regards to results, we just had Minsky and the University of Minnesota give us results of students required to take remedial courses when they're going to college, get caught up with where the other students are at. On that basis, I've had 4 school districts in the top 15 in my district, and they're all small. So I refute whatever average of results you want to bring to the table, but I think by so doing, I think we're going to be creating haves and have-nots, and they're already doing that in the state of Minnesota. Thank you.
Representative Barling, did all your witnesses intend to speak? because I have three other people. Well, I have two people who want to testify against the bill, and I think you still had Leah Sly who wanted to speak.
Madam Chair, Leah Sly was also on the list. She's the last one. I don't know if she wants a minute or two. Just briefly to represent Heidgerken, you know, open enrollment was debated 20 years ago or whatever, so I don't think we're here to debate that today. But if you want to, I would love to go to dinner with you.
Thank you.
You get to buy Representative Heidgerken. Okay, let's hear from the other two people. Well, first, we had a question from Representative Clinton, and then we will go on to the other two testifiers.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It was mentioned that your levy is, well, let me start by saying it looks like this is a statewide property tax that's mostly going to affect places with heavy commercial, industrial properties, as well as lots of seasonal rec properties, primarily up north and maybe even a little bit south where some of the lakes are. Is that primarily where these students are coming from who are open enrolling into your school? Is there a way to do it so that the money they had in their former district is coming with them, as opposed to having this as a tax on folks who probably don't live close enough to open enroll into the great school in St. Anthony?
Madam Chair.
Representative Greiling.
Thank you, Representative Clinton. As I said at the beginning, I remember this bill got hung up on the funding source last year. We tried to find a funding source because we had no money in this committee. This year, there is going to be money, so I'm happy to amend this bill to have it be an open funding source like your bill and like Representative Dempsey's bill. I don't want to get hung up on where the money came from. We drafted it this way last year because there was no money in this committee. But it's my intention to not have us focus on the funding source, because if that's the objection, then I will change it anytime in the process. But so there was no reason for it. It wasn't where they came from. It was just we were looking for a funding source.
Representative Biskin.
Quick
follow-up. Oh, I'm sorry. Do you have a follow-up?
Yeah, just a quick follow-up then for that. Just as we continue our discussion about it then, because it was also mentioned the levies cap based on the resident students in the district. Would the voters in St. Anthony be open to capping it based on pupil enrollment, or would that make it kind of difficult, I guess, to pass that sort of referendum?
Madam Chair,
Representative Greiling.
Representative Quentin, I would mention, too, which I should have done at the beginning, this is not just for this one district. The handout that you have in your packet shows that there's a lot of districts that would benefit from changing this, and there's less than 10 that meet the 100% threshold, but if you have 40% of your students, then you get, you know, the $400, if you have 10%. So it's on a sliding scale, as I said, based on how many students you have. So it's meant for a whole range of districts all around the state who have varying degrees of open enrolled students. And the whole principle is to have at least some of the money follow the child. I believe this committee has, you know, kind of had the philosophy that the money follows the child. And this is the one area where we haven't. And we realize that the resident district is currently keeping the money, and I wasn't anxious to take money from any district given the drought that we've had for school funding with this bill, and especially when local property taxpayers pass these levies, they might have something to say about us taking money from their own property taxes and sending it to any of these other districts.
Representative Distance.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, and I think Representative Greiling just touched on my last question. Because it would seem to me that if you were to follow, it'd be true to the principle that you're trying to bring forward here, all right, that there would, you know, it's a funding issue again, and I apologize for that, but to be true to the principle of your idea, that you're bringing forward here. You would think that while you're asking for an adjustment on students that enter into a district, there should probably, from a state perspective, also be an adjustment to districts that lose students. And so then the answer to your funding is right there.
Declining enrollment.
It's in the the give and take of where the students are going and having the dollars follow the children specifically. So I guess that and frankly, you know, there is something, right, to be said about competition, and America was built on that, and possibly one can speculate that if the dollars truly followed the child, the schools that seemed and the districts that seem to be losing a lot of students to open enrollment might need to be looking at how they're serving kids and making the necessary adjustments so that they don't lose their students to open enrollment.
Representative Bernardi.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Greiling mentioned when I raised my hand. I went through, I'm a data person, I went through here and just highlighted the people that are affected, this orange highlighting, that had 10% 10% increase in their students coming from outside their district, or get 10% of their students from outside their district. And it's all over the state. It's not just St. Anthony. You happen to be, last time I knew your numbers were 50%, and now I see they're 75%. So this definitely is a choice program. I mean, it's not like online learning, which my school district has, or it's not some flashy new program that will look good like a new initiative is going. This is school districts that are doing well and attracting students and giving choice need this type of funding. And I don't think we should be hung up on where the funding's coming, because we didn't get hung up on the other two. And so let's talk about the merit of it, and reward schools and allow them to have the funding for the students that they need that are coming in. So I'm very supportive of this, and let's not get hung up on the funding.
Thank you, Representative Bernardi. Representative Heidgerken, last question, then we are going to hear from our last two people.
We could go back and forth on this all day. I'll just pass. All right, thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Ms. Sly, did you still wish to speak?
If there's time, but I don't need to. Okay. Open enrollment fundamentally allows students with their parents to research and select a school that best meets their particular needs and interests, what will best help them best reach their goals. One size does not necessarily fit all. Others have mentioned the draw of our school's academic excellence, and to me that's very important as a parent. But many also find our smaller size attractive, and one of the things that facilitates is greater participation in extracurricular activities. That's another area where students develop character and build self-esteem. And many of those extracurricular activities like Knowledge Bowl or Jazz Band or Speech Team are unavailable to some of our open enrolled students in their own districts, but in our district they can participate and grow. Conversely, a few of our residents feel that a larger school would better meet their needs, and open enrollment allows for that, allows for them to pick what they want. One young lady in town is very active in theater, and so she picked a larger school that would facilitate that interest. But in either case, the providing school district is educating the students who have made that choice with less money than they receive for the resident students. In our case, we attract far more students than we lose, and that creates a financial burden. So school choice via open enrollment can enhance quality education across the board in Minnesota for students who choose to participate in that. And districts who successfully provide that service ought to receive equitable funding. Try to make it shorter. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I appreciate you trying to speed it up. Actually, we have two more witnesses on this bill, and then another group who is going to make a presentation on UFARS. So we are moving along here. Let's see. We have Mr. Bartholomew and Mr. Hesse, right?
Hello, Madam Chair.
Mr. Bartholomew.
My name is Jim Bartholomew. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Business Partnership. And I want to thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today about House File 195. wanted to thank Representative Greiling since last spring, actually, for her willingness to talk about her bill and the issues that she's trying to resolve. Unfortunately, at this point, we would encourage you not to adopt the current version of the bill as drafted. With that said, the business partnership has been and continues to be a very strong supporter of the open enrollment program. Open enrollment's record of success in terms of expanding educational opportunities for students is a strong one, and I very much appreciated the comments of the parents today about what they meant for trying to find the educational program that meets their kids and works most appropriately. In many ways, St. Anthony is a good example of how this program can benefit both students as well as school districts. Students have enrolled in the St. Anthony District for the educational opportunities and benefits. At the same time, the St. Anthony School District has benefited from the over 800 students that they've been able to attract, as well as the corresponding revenue. To the degree that there's a funding glitch in the open enrollment program relative to referendum dollars, House File 195 does offer one solution, and in a moment, perhaps suggest another, and regrettably didn't get a chance to talk to Representative Greiling earlier. But I'll get to that in just a moment. We would encourage you not to increase the statewide property tax to pay for House File 195. There are a number of reasons why we would make that argument, but suffice it to say that increasing taxes on employers inhibits our ability to compete in an increasingly competitive environment. As an alternative, two alternatives actually, to increasing the statewide property tax, we would encourage the state to look at ways to improve the efficiency or productivity of existing program and service delivery. And I had a chance to talk with many of you about that in relation to this bill, as well as through the efforts of the Coalition of Minnesota Businesses, and you may remember getting these from time to time. And one of our cards talked about improving productivity in the delivery of government services. Another alternative that may work for the problem that Representative Greiling is trying to raise, having had just brief discussions, but following the model used for charter schools. Charter schools are on a similar basis that the St. Anthony School District is, in the sense, but it, as Representative Biskins intimated, it's referendum aid follows the student from the district of residence to the school or district that's serving the child. After some short conversations, it sounds like it would be a revenue-neutral solution. Probably the biggest glitch, though, might be that it would require a fair amount of administrative work from the Department of Education and trying to make the proper calculations. But again, I think there's some options out there. We certainly, obviously, can't support the option proposed in this bill, but we think there are other ways to get to skin the cat. With that, I'd like to say again, thank you for the time. Again, I hope you would not adopt the current version of the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Bartholomew. Mr. Hesse.
Madam Chair and members, for the record, my name is Tom Hesse. I'm with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. And not to duplicate the comments of Mr. Bartholomew, I'll be brief. The Minnesota Chamber also supports a wide variety of school choice options, including open enrollment. However, I'm here mostly to talk about Section 2 of the bill, which is the increase in the statewide property tax that is paid primarily by commercial industrial property taxpayers of the state. We do not support that funding mechanism, even though it's a relatively small dollar increase in the tax, $2 million on the base. It seems that if we make an exception for this particular program, there will be many, many exceptions to come, and this $2 million increase in the statewide property tax could turn out to be a much bigger and bigger burden on Minnesota businesses. With that, Madam Chair, I'd just be happy to answer any questions.
I thank you, gentlemen, very much. There don't appear to be any questions, and we still have another group that has been trying to look at the UFAR system and maybe look at it in a more business-type perspective and maybe have some good suggestions for us. Oh, I'm sorry. We need to lay your bill over. Would you like to make that motion, please?
Madam Chair, I would, and thank you and the committee members for the time. I would like to underscore, which I don't know if it came through loud and clear enough with these two testifiers, they support the bill. It's the funding source they're talking about. The Chamber of Commerce has a position here on K-12 education that we all received this year, saying that they support increased financial accountability, including operating levy referenda dollars, must continue to follow the student of their choice and be accounted for at that school site. So I hope we can go forward with this bill and focus on the idea that I think a lot of us would support, and the funding source can be worked on as we go along.
Did you move your bill, Representative Riley?
I did at the beginning.
All right.
Yes.
Then thank you very much, folks. And gentlemen, I'm sorry we ended up so short of time. These all took a little longer than I expected. One can never guess. And whichever way I guess, I'm usually wrong. So.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Committee. My name is Ward Eames, and I'm a business owner in West Metro Golden Valley. And I have with me Chuck Seltzer. We represent something quite a bit different. For 13 years, I have been a volunteer in various schools, in the schools that my kids have been at. And I have been trying to understand school financing from the point of view of balance sheets and income statement and understanding how to follow the dollars that our districts are getting and spending. And to tell you the truth, I couldn't figure it out. I don't know about you guys, but I couldn't. What we did was last summer, we got a group of people together that were business owners, and I run a group called the Hopkins LAC Business Task Force, which is a group of 76 business owners supporting public schools in the Hopkins School District. And we got together with some parents and some accountants and some legislators, and we said, is there a way to take the UFARs and turn it into a report that doesn't change UFARs, but does change the way the reporting is done for those of us who are not school finance experts, and have an understanding of how the money is spent and how the money is collected. And we took the concept and put together a committee of business managers from Hopkins, Wayzata, and Minnetonka, and also St. Paul, and looked at this and came up with the beginnings of a report, which you have in front of you, which takes the concept of basic accounting with cost of goods sold and understanding what that means from a service business, and having a report that is able to easily translate the UFARs and the reporting of the schools into a report that those of us who are not experts can read. I'd like to direct you to page 4 of the... This is a report that takes Minnetonka's funding and turns it into a one-page report for us to understand how the money is used, where the money goes, where the money comes from, and all ties back to UFARs. And the UFARs, we did this then for Hopkins. We do this for St. Paul. We do this for, actually, there are other districts that have just signed on, Austin, Faribault, Spring Lake Park, and Roseville. We're going to just take this and see if they could easily translate this information. I'm going to turn it over to my accountant friend here, business owner as well, on part of the LAC Business Task Force, to take you through this just basically so that you can understand and we can be able to compare one district to another district to another district, apples to oranges, in a way that's understandable.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Chuck Seltzer. I'm a CPA, and it's actually a pleasure to be away from the office at this time of year, to be here in this laid-back atmosphere comparative to where I was. There are two bromides I might offer to you. One is that information is inherently divided into three categories: what you need to know, what's nice to know, and what you don't need to know. and also that the quality of decisions reached is directly proportional to the quality of information you had available when you reached your decision. So what we're trying to do here is get information to not only legislative bodies, but also people in a school district or parents of people that is understandable. The audited financial statement of the Hopkins School District is 88 pages long. The audited financial statement of the Minnetonka School District was over 90 pages long. But the audited financial statements of Exxon are 42 pages long. I think Exxon is less complicated than the school district. I don't think so. What we've got here is a system that is very complex, and so we've got in front of you, I think, something we're very excited about that eventually we might be able to turn into a report that we can do for all schools across the state. But we've piloted it with the school districts that that Ward has told you about. What we have here is on the left side, just a summary of the sources of funds. Where does the money come from? What's local, what's state, what's federal? And then the uses of that money. And that is really a story of the general fund of a school district. We also show below that those other funds, such as the debt financing that some people like to lump in together into the general fund, but we've got it separated out. And once again, the bottom line of this presentation will tie to the bottom line of a financial statement done on UFARS. We've taken that information to the right and put it into pie charts. Our group, by the way, was not interested in drawing any conclusions on any information. We had no agendas with regard to what ratios might be or what they might say. Our only goal in life was to give information to people like you that is readily understandable. At the bottom, we think we put together some key statistics and key analytical benchmarks, such as number of students, such as enrollment levels at various levels of the educational process. And once again, to the right are some graphs. If anyone wants to drill down further, when you turn the page, there is the operating statement of the operating fund. So these are the numbers that summarize and come forward to that first page. So if you want more detail, here it is. When you get to that use of revenue category and we get to that cost of sales concept, cost for providing teaching and learning, those are the different categories within. And you see some terminology there. What does leadership mean? We've enclosed three pages behind here a glossary. First, on page 8, just a summary of what makes up these different funds. What's in each fund? What do they mean? At page 9, some of the terminology. So we are not using jargon. When we go out to the public, we're not using terminology that's misunderstood. And everybody has a clear understanding of what is in each of these categories. If you go to the next page, page 6, we do the same thing on a drill down basis with those other funds, such as food and nutritional services, community ed, capital projects, and debt financing. Once again, the mission of our committee was not to find some conclusions, verify someone's biases. All we really put together here, I think, is a very exciting process and format that I think we can take to the road and we can easily get comparative data and will be, I think, very helpful, for example, in that pilot project as you move towards the 65%, if that's what comes out. I think it's just a very exciting product. And so if any one of you has access to an audited financial statement of a school district in your area and you want to take a look at that 80 pages, go ahead. Compare it to this, and I think you'll find, and by the way, this is my profession that's done this, and that is that in that audited financial statement, there's information you need to know, there's information you might want to know, and there's also a lot of information you don't need to know. This, we think, is what you need to know.
Thank you, Chuck. Last point. This takes about one day for a qualified accounting backroom person in each of those districts to take their financials and translate them into this. We've got the spreadsheet that's been created that all they do is plug in their numbers and this report falls out. And we think that on a policy level that one day when you have simplified and, you know, understandable financials, that you will be able to have benchmarks. You will be able to say, you know what, they're spending 81% directly to the student, and another district is spending 65% directly to the student, and we think 81% is better. Or another person, another group is having higher debt than another school district. In this formula that you have now, that's so hard to pull out and to understand. In this, it will be easy. And I'm not saying that there are benchmarks yet, because I don't think we've gone through this long enough and had enough years of doing this. But I do encourage you to take a look at this. We will, in the middle of March, have all of the data from each of those districts, just like this, in this format, from all of the districts that I mentioned, including St. Paul, including Austin. And if any of you have a smaller rural school district that you'd like to, smaller than Austin, smaller than Faribault, that you'd like to have us take a look at and give the information to them for, we'd love to have that data as well. And we hope to come back sometime when we have all of that comparative data, and as business people to say, try to adopt something like this and have the, encourage the school districts to report their information in a way that's understandable. And now I'll open for questions.
Are there any questions? I have to really compliment you guys on everything you've done. I would like to hear, Mr. Strom, how likely is it that we could get districts to report this way?
Madam Chair, the witnesses could certainly tell you much more about this than me. I think it's important to remember that UFARS originated in the mid-70s primarily as a way for the state to impose upon districts a uniform system of accounting. It really hasn't changed much in 30 years. A lot of the rest of the world has changed very much. But at the time, what UFARS was designed to do was make sure that all schools accounted for everything in the same manner. One of the problems, as they mentioned, is we have these very long crosswalk definitions of what expenditures are and what revenues are, and that leads to a lot of differentiation that I think doesn't mean much to the average person. So I'm maybe not answering your question well, but I do think that it's important to keep in mind that UFARS is basically a 35-year-old system.
Madam Chair, I guess I'd like to address that. I think.
Yes, Mr. Seltzer.
Oh, thank you. I think actually UFARS is what makes this possible. Notwithstanding that it's a very large chart of accounts that's mandated by UFARS, what we've done is create a model that ties to UFARS. So as long as we've got districts that are using UFARS, and my understanding is they all have to, and some of them are in different levels of kind of getting used to UFARS than others, but as long as their chart of accounts is a UFARS chart of accounts, we can create these reports with the model we've constructed. So I think it's actually a pretty small process for each district if they want to do it.
Members, we are now running over time. I have two questions, so we'll allow the two people with questions to ask their questions, and then we will adjourn. Representative Demmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick comment. As a school board member, this would have been great to have information like this. We always struggled with trying to get the financial data, and we had, in my time, a couple different superintendents, and everybody had their own take on trying to give us the detail or the information in a manner that was meaningful. And I have a business background. I can read balance sheets and income statements, and school financial reporting is not that way. Second is a question. Did you work with the Department of Education at all on this? Have they looked at this? Where are they at?
We have not. We have worked directly with the business managers of the various districts, and worked with our business constituents, and we actually vetted this in front of our business task force, just bringing in business people and saying, here's some comparative financial data, what more would you want, what less, and it changed, and it changed, and it changed, and now we've come up with what we think is what our business people are saying, hey, I can understand that. And that urban myth that, you know, all the money is going into administration, when you look at it, you have a different view, because this is, you know, looking at what a business looks at when they try and have a service business or a nonprofit. And Chuck has done a lot of nonprofit schools and other organizations, and so it ties to what's out there in the general marketplace as well.
Well, Mr. Ames and Mr. Seltzer, thank you so much. Maybe we can have you another time where you really do some good comparisons for us so we can get a better sense of what's happening.
I think we'd be happy to. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And Representative Greiling?
Madam Chair, I need the minutes of the February 15th meeting.
Isn't that wonderful how she's just right on the ball?
Yeah.
Are there any additions or corrections to the minutes, please? Hearing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Minutes are adopted and the meeting is adjourned. By the way, next week we will be doing all these different levy bills, all these different bills proposing levies for this and levies for that.